There's an old cliche in politics. Nothing seems to happen for ages, and then everything seems to happen all at once. For London in the start of the 15th century, this does appear to be incredibly true. The city seemed to have become a barometer for a brand new regime, springing into life after the vicious miasma of the years of Richard II, with the hope that things would now change. Last episode, we focused on national events. How and why Henry Bolingbroke ended up taking the throne of England. And here he is, the lord of a new regime, and London's in the front row of what's about to happen. As Henry rapidly tried to consolidate his kingdom, London was forced by necessity to be all up in his business. And it is from London's point of view that we witness the events of the following few years. In particular, this episode, I'll be looking at the words of one Adam of Usk. His account of events, while never to be taken as completely accurate or to be used alone, does give us some colourful insights into London at this time. Hi, my name is Saul, and you are listening to The Story of London, the podcast that tries to tell the chronology of this great city in weekly parts, presenting everything as a grand narrative story. We have reached round about the years 1399 and 1400, the start of the 15th century. An episode involving a faltering regime, a couple of riots, plenty of executions, screams of people being burned alive on the streets, urban renewal, death of some poets, visiting dignitaries. Yeah, medieval London's in full swing. Welcome then to the 144th chapter of this story of London, and thus reduced to ashes. King Richard II had been toppled. Henry IV was now the monarch. It was, no matter how you want to word it, a coup d'etat, a usurpation. The technically next in line for the throne, pushing out the current holder and putting himself in his place. And despite London avoiding almost every aspect of the campaign by Henry Bolingbroke to overthrow Richard and make himself king, well, the moment he won, London was involved due to the great mechanisms of ritual taking over. I mean, the coronation was, as always, filled with the usual pageantry with London as its backdrop. On a rain-soaked Sunday on October the 12th, 1399, Henry rode from the Tower of London on his formal procession through the streets of the city and towards Westminster Abbey. Despite the rain, Henry rode bareheaded and sat upon a magnificent white horse. He wore a short-fitted jacket, a doublet, which was woven from golden cloth. On his left leg was a blue garter belt, and around his neck hung the badge of the Kingdom of France. He wanted to send out a signal that he was not giving up the Plantagenet claim to the French throne. In his wake came 2,000 clerks, servants, knights, ladies and lords, all wearing newly made robes and themselves riding many thousands of horses in procession. The mayor of London and the myriad of citizens were part of this grand procession, wearing splendid scarlet liveries, fur trimmed, adorned with the badges of the many livery companies. From the houses that stood behind the teeming, roaring crowds, rich hangings and decorations hung in colourful profusion, and as always, here and there, conduits ran red with wine. After the formal ceremony in Westminster Abbey, in the nearby newly refurbished Westminster Hall, the mayor and the aldermen then took their pride of place. Tradition dictated that the barons of the Cinqports, places like Dover, and the mayor and aldermen of London would always be sat at tables just below the kings during coronation feasts, places of honour and grandness. And sat in their magnificent seating places, the mayor and the aldermen would have seen some grand pageantry during the feast. Apparently about halfway through the great coronation celebration, the great north door to the hall slammed open to reveal Sir Thomas Dummock, the king's champion, armed from head to foot, bearing a sword sheathed in black with a golden hilt, and sitting astride one of the king's more impressive war horses. On either side of Dummock were two more mounted knights, one bearing Dummock's spear and the other his shield with all its heraldry on. Before the assembled guests, the king's champion and his companions rode their horses right up the middle of the hall, and then approached the herald and handed him a scroll, onto which were written the following words, quote, "If there is any man, high or low, of any estate or condition, who says that Henry, King of England, here present and crowned this day, is not the rightful king nor rightfully crowned, I will either now, or whenever our Lord King determines, offer him battle with my body, and prove that he is a false liar," unquote. Sir Dimmock then circled the hall, stopping at each of the corners of it, and the challenge on that scroll was repeated aloud in both French and English each time. The story goes that after the final rendition, the king stood and said, "If need be, Sir Thomas, I shall personally relieve you of this task." It was a hell of a piece of political theatre. But political theatre was needed. The most dangerous time in any new regime was always when the regime took over. Clouds of uncertainty hung over the power structure. And it is true that even now you had those who had always supported this new regime with their sudden decision to take power, and those who still supported the old one. These two factions would soon be at odds, especially as the new king's supporters wanted some payback. By that October, in Parliament and in the King's Council, battle lines were drawn up over one event above all to begin with, the murder of the King's uncle, the Duke of Gloucester. As we mentioned a few episodes ago, the key witness to this was a royal valet, who was currently being held in the squalor of London's Newgate Jail, a man called John Hall. Manacled and shackled, Hall was dragged from Newgate, taken down Fleet Street, and arrived at Westminster to be brought before the Parliament on Saturday the 18th of October. It is from him that we learn that he was an eyewitness to the murder of the Duke of Gloucester, and the gory details came out. The poor man was suffocated under a feathered bed by half a dozen esquires and valets in the back room of the Prince's Inn in Calais. But while this was shocking, John Hall caused even more heads to turn by being very clear as to upon whom the orders these men were following when they killed the Duke. The orders were from the Dukes of Arundel, Norfolk, and above all, the former King himself. There was immediate uproar in Parliament of this as, well, several of the people accused were in the Parliament. One supporter of the King threw down his hood and screamed at the Duke of Arundel, quote, "You, Arundel, were responsible for the death of the Duke of Gloucester. You were midwife to his murder," unquote. The uproar was intense and there was, quote, "such a mighty tumult and clamour from the Commons offering battle at this point that the King was afraid that the Duke was about to be put to death before his very eyes," unquote. King Henry tried multiple times to calm the room down, finally bellowing out that he would not allow anyone to take the law into their own hands. He calmed the room, but people's blood was up, and the need to vent fury had a nearby obvious target. While his testimony had helped implicate others, and while there is every argument that he would not have witnessed the murder of the Duke unless somebody ordered him to be there, John Hall did not survive that day. It was ruled that he should be punished by, quote, "the harshest death to which he could possibly be sentenced, since the Duke of Gloucester was so great a personage," unquote. Before the day was out, John Hall was taken back to the Tower of London, prepared, and then drawn by a hurdle from Tower Hill to that new place of death, Tyburn, where he was hanged, then disemboweled, then beheaded, before his body was cut apart. Tyburn was a grim place, and this region was fairly uninhabited and desolate. Local residents complained that the old church there, which we think was St. Ethelburga the Virgin, was located, quote, "in too lonely a place," unquote, and that, quote, "on account of the snares and plunderings of robbers, The books, vestments, images, bells, and other ornaments cannot be preserved as they should be, unquote. Small wonder, then, that this was chosen as the place of death for London going forward. And yet, this uproar is indicative of something actually quite important going on. For all the pressing needs of state which King Henry inherited, after this initial flurry of activity, the passions of the king's new councillors were not so much looking forward, but more fascinated by the recent past. We see no immediate long-term provisions being made for the nation. The wool subsidy was renewed for 3 years, but the tonnage and poundage and the direct taxation was neither requested nor granted. King Henry seemed focused upon recovering the former king's jewels and other movable wealth and was asked to settle Richard's debts and to repay his loans. We see a heap of titles being dropped upon his 13-year-old son, also called Henry, but now designated Prince of Wales and Duke of Lancaster. It is perhaps no surprise, then, that in a regime focused on getting those who supported Richard II, that the former supporters of Richard II would seek to strike back. The Epiphany Rising is a name given to a plot to assassinate the new king and his sons and restore King Richard to the throne. Led by the Earls of Kent, Huntington and Salisbury, along with a man called Thomas the Spencer, who was a former Earl of Gloucester, all men who had seen their ranks reduced in the new regime, it included a bevy of lower-ranking knights and a whole bunch of king's servants, and even William Colchester, the abbot of Westminster Abbey, was implicated. Their plan was simple. They were going to wait until January 6th, the Feast of the Epiphany, and while the new king and his family were celebrating the end of Christmas in Windsor Castle, they'd turn up and, well, stick him with a sword. Henry had suffered from food poisoning that Christmas, so his festivities over the season had been low-key. The conspiracy planned to use his final day's burst of activities, such as jousting and masks, as cover for their strike. While the evidence is not clear, there is a suggestion that at least one of these conspirators engaged in the services of a young female prostitute from London. Who this nameless woman was, we do not know, but her client bragged to her as to what he was part of. And the implication is that this woman then informed the authorities, and that directly as a result of this, the Mayor of London hurried to Windsor to advise the king to come to the city at once. Now, this may not have been the only way the king discovered this plot. Some within the conspiracy certainly did turn state's evidence before it happened. But it did mean that by the time the rebel lords all met as prearranged in Kingston-upon-Thames on Sunday the 4th of January, the king did indeed know about the plot and was already travelling to London, summoning retainers as he went, where he met the mayor. Now, Mayor Thomas Knowles, who was Mayor of London at the time, raised the citizens of the city to be ready to serve their king, which was useful. The rebels, realising they'd been unmasked, nevertheless rode to Windsor, where they rather pointlessly proclaimed that King Richard II was the true king. And then, by that evening, several had fled all over, including a large body to Cirencester. There, the locals, alerted beforehand, arrested them and locked them in a nearby abbey. The arrested rebels and started a fire to try to escape, failed to escape, and were then just dragged out into the marketplace and beheaded. The others were rounded up in drips and draps, and the king himself, having arrived at London with his royal retainers, supplemented his forces with men of London, happily supplied by the mayor. And then this new armed force rode with Henry IV to bring justice to the ringleaders. By the time they all reached Oxford on the 11th of January, the whole thing was over. And the Londoners who came with the king witnessed the trials that followed in Oxford thereon. Some 90 men had stood accused, most of whom were quickly pardoned since they were just little people press-ganged into joining the rising. Although 27 were convicted and sentenced to a traitor's death. Now, technically, most of these were simply beheaded, since, as King Henry himself put it, quote, "The sight of so many people being put to death would be quite horrid, and the sound of it most piteous," unquote. Remember, traitors' deaths were really extraordinarily brutal. It was at this exact moment, by the way, that we rediscovered the man who supposedly came from Southwark, called John Ferrer, who I mentioned all the way back in chapter 133. John Ferrer was supposedly the man who saved the teenage Henry of Bolingbroke in the Tower of London from the mob during the Peasants' Revolt, and he was now implicated in the Epiphany Rising. Henry IV took one look and said, "You, oh yeah, you saved my life. I'm letting you off," which was nice. But several of the leaders around him did suffer the full grisly fate of traitors of the realm. Adam of Usk commented that the main leaders of the rebellion, well, their bodies had been, quote, chopped up like the carcasses of beasts killed in the chase, partly in sacks and partly in poles slung across pairs of men's shoulders, where they were later salted to preserve them, unquote. They were salting to preserve the bodies so they could display them. These bodies were then escorted by the Londoners back to the city for the proper rites of traitors in this harsh place. The direct result of this uprising was that King Richard II was killed, probably starved to death on the new king's orders. By the 17th of February 1400, news of his death was widely known, and one of the new royal esquires was sent to bring his corpse from Pontefract to London. The party that brought his body to London did move slowly, and the corpse was publicly exhibited at the major routes along the route, quote, or at least that part of the body from which his face could be recognised, that is, from his forehead to his throat, unquote. Upon arriving in London, he was ceremoniously displayed in St. Paul's Cathedral, and then after 2 days of funeral rites, sometime round about the 6th or 7th of March, his body was taken to King's Langley in Hertfordshire for burial, quote, at the dead of night, unquote. The reason for displaying the body like this? Henry wanted to make sure that everybody knew King Richard was dead. Unfortunately, even with his body being seen, some people believed he wasn't. But we'll get back to that. Meanwhile, as for London as a city, it now tried to move on. From the year 1400, we see London centrally placed to be a crucial part of the new regime, as much as they had been under King Richard. London's richer merchants knew that the key to their success was making sure they could supply the new regime with cash. And not only enough, the new king needed cash. Understand, Henry had gained the royal treasury, and since Richard II had been amassing a fortune in the years just before he was deposed, this meant that Henry IV did have a ready supply of very short-term cash at hand. But the amount of money he spent covering his campaign, and also discovering that the costs of English commitments to military needs, was huge. I mean, even now, in a period of supposed peace, the military budget of England roughly amounted to £50,000 a year. That's about £30 million in today's money. There was a cost of maintaining protection on the garrison at Calais, at maintaining fortresses in Aquitaine, maintaining the borders with Scotland, and also maintaining a garrison over in Ireland. Now, there was some talk, given the sheer amount of cash required to run the country, that maybe the revenues of the Duchy of Lancaster should contribute to the Crown's accounts. But Henry IV was adamant this would not be happening. He had just bloody well waged a war to regain that title. The Duchy of Lancaster was not going to be merged into Crown Estates. It was separate. And he put it all into his son's keeping as heir to the throne. And that, he said, would be that. By the way, for English listeners, this is why the Duchy of Lancaster's estates to this day are held separate from other royal accounts, and why the heir to the throne still retains them and still gets a yearly salary, I think, of about £22 million a year. It all stems from Henry IV. Anyway, the main revenues, therefore, that Henry IV was gaining as king was from the taxation on the sale of wool, which would, in a good year, be about £40,000. So it was an immediate shortfall, and the gap had to be covered by loans. In 1400, we see the Royal Exchequer borrowed more than £20,000 during this first year, the most generous individual lender being, Richard Whittington, the London mercer and former and future mayor of the city. It was probably to facilitate borrowing from the city that Whittington and two of his fellow Londoners, a man called John Shadworth and another called William Brampton, were named as members of the Royal Council in November 1399, although it should be noted that Whittington only ever attended one Royal Council the following June. But understand from the word go, Henry IV was not some frugal king cutting back on royal expenditure compared to the rather in love with the expensive trappings of Majesty former King Richard. Henry spent lavishly, and within a few years, the royal household's shortfalls were becoming a major talking point. The year 1400, as itself, was one of loss for London, and while not perhaps monumental at the time, it saw the death of Geoffrey Chaucer. The civil servant and occasional poet died that October, and his great work, The Canterbury Tales, was still unfinished. He'd lived his last few years as a widower, living on his pension, away from London in a house in the garden of Lady Chapel, Westminster. He'd spent his last few years in relative peace, if not slightly concerned as the years went on because of the funds he was owed, but ultimately it'd be quite some time before that unfinished poem would grant him his great posthumous fame. But his death saw that he, as a tenant of Westminster Abbey, was given permission to be buried in the Abbey grounds. And in time, the location of his burial site would lead that region to be known as Poet's Corner today. At least, that's according to the popular tradition. 1400 also saw the death of another great artist, the mason, builder and architect Henry Yeveley. Supposedly in his 70s by now, Yeveley had, since the mid-1350s, been one of London's most important masons. He'd overseen the rebuilding of Kennington Palace for Edward the Black Prince back in the day, and after that he went on to become the principal architect for many of the improvements on the Tower of London, and he was ultimately responsible for the mammoth reconstruction of Westminster Hall. We know around them, as these men passed, London remained a place of tension, regardless of whatever royal regime was in control. Even before Bolingbroke had landed, the Duke of York, who'd been left as guardian of the realm during the King's absence in Ireland, had actually moved the royal government to St Albans, most certainly because he felt he was in danger from Londoners being located in the not very well defended Westminster Palace. We have cases from just before the regime change of people like a man called John Sewale of Islington, who had been arrested and brought before the mayor for saying, quote, "that we'll have no peace or love in England since the present King of England became king," in a like manner did further say that he is not the rightful king, unquote. So, yeah, we know there was tension in London towards Richard II. And one of the Richard II's last acts before leaving to go to Ireland had actually been to restore the monopoly of the fishmongers, allowing that trade and its members try to recover their old prominence. But that, again, caused tensions. It's a measure of how smart London was, reading the ongoing political tensions, that they selected William Hale as one of the sheriffs and elected Thomas Knowles as mayor in 1399, because that suggests that the city was deliberately choosing as its officers leading grocers who everybody knew were looked favourably upon by the new king because of their known Lancasterian sympathies. This new mayor then was rewarded for his loyalty to the king during the Epiphany Uprising by being given 2 tenements and 9 shops in Soper's Lane, Needles Lane. They'd formerly belonged to Thomas Romaine and had recently been forfeited to the crown. Knowles and William Hyde were also granted exemption to the collections of subsidies and taxes for a short time. So London was reading the political mood just as the new king started fairly well. The year 1400, however, also saw the unexpected arrival of the Byzantine emperor himself, Manuel II. This state visit was to last 2 whole months. On the one hand, it was a blessing when the Byzantine Empire stepped foot in Dover on December the 11th of that year. Here was one of Europe's great political figures, the Byzantine emperor, more than willing to acknowledge the English king's new regime, happy to allow the ancient glamour of his status trickle down upon the new king. Of course, the Byzantine emperor was not here to see King Henry specifically. He was on a grand tour of Western Europe, you see, having called into Venice and Milan and Paris beforehand. And the reason he was here was because his empire was crumbling all around him, and Constantinople was being blockaded by this new force that had emerged in the Middle East, a bunch of nomadic steppe people who had settled down, converted to Islam, and were calling themselves the Turks. The Byzantine emperor was desperately seeking rulers in Western Europe to contribute men or money. It was fundamentally a call for crusade again. Now, it should be noted, as I said all the way back in chapter 55, the Crusades had had a profound impact upon London, and it had all seemed to culminate in King Edward III. He'd actually gone on crusade to the Holy Land, and had been there when he'd inherited the throne. Now, tradition always says he was the last English king involved in the Crusades, but technically, right now in 1400, that was not the case. You see, Henry IV was a crusader. Now, his involvement in the Crusades is actually overlooked, mostly because he never went anywhere near the Middle East. But he had sailed out to join the Crusades of the Teutonic Knights over in what is today Poland and Lithuania. He'd led English forces fighting in the Baltic. He'd apparently besieged Vilnius for a brief while, and he held very powerful positive affirmations as his time as a crusader in the Baltic. And because of that, the Byzantine emperor may have hoped that Henry would be inclined to aid him. Henry certainly entertained him in Eltham Palace, and for 2 months, and organised splendid entertainments over the Christmas holidays, including a great mummer's play put on by the Alderman of London, and then loaded him up with gifts for his departure. The emperor said in letters that King Henry was willing to promise to provide soldiers and archers and ships to carry them and funds to pay for them, all to help. But even if the former crusader Henry had made such promises, he was in no position to help. The cost of entertaining the emperor and his 50-strong household for 2 months was high, and in the end, the emperor departed with nothing more than £2,000, which Richard II had promised him years ago and had never got round to paying. Money was tight. No, seriously. Economically, London was still dealing with a spate of bankruptcies and commercial depressions. Now, this had been the thing that stoked the fires of London's antipathy towards Richard II. But alas, the depressed economic situation had not dissipated with the elevation of a new king. And the impact of this ongoing, prevailing economic downturn we see erupt on the streets of London around about Lent of 1401. Adam of Usk's description of what happened is especially vivid. Quote, "In this Lent, the lads of the city of London, often gathering together in thousands and choosing kings amongst themselves, made war upon one another and fought to their utmost strength, whereby many died, stricken with blows, or trampled underfoot, or crushed in the narrow ways, much to the wonder of the people. Yet from such gatherings they could not be restrained, until the king wrote to their parents and masters with grievous threats to prevent them," unquote. It does seem indeed that the apprentices of the city decided to kick off. Now, we don't know the exact cause of these riots, but it is highly probable that many of the apprentices of London had found themselves abandoned and without their jobs, fired as a consequence of their masters' failures and the massive economic downturn. And even more who still had jobs were seeing their future prospects of becoming independent citizens of London diminishing by the day. It would suggest that things would kick off. But longer-term serious public disorder was offset, as it seems a sixth outbreak of the plague in London took place, which Usk described as a, quote, "great plague prevailed through all England, and especially amongst the young, swift in its attack and carrying off many souls," unquote. But it's safe to assume that continuing unrest in London, linked to the ongoing economic difficulties, along with increased migration to the city from elsewhere, was probably behind the ordinance issued in September 1402, that wards were to submit 4 candidates when they elected an alderman, out of whom the mayor and the sitting alderman would choose one. The city's authorities clearly had no intention of allowing a second John de Northampton to exploit these economic difficulties for political purposes, since the common people were apparently already complaining about their new rulers, and some were saying they'd rather have King Richard. Trade was stuck in a depressed state, and because of that, London was unable to provide employment for all those who sought it here. We know that the grocers increased the fee for their members to take up apprentices to double the amount it had been in as recently as 1399, to 6 shillings and 8 pence, while the goldsmiths charged 20 shillings per apprentice. In the next few years, possibly because of this, London did not oppose something called the Statute of Apprentices. This was a law which was designed to stop the depleted populations of the countryside from sending their children to towns, and made it illegal for townsmen to take apprentices from any families who had incomes of less than 20 shillings a year in land or rent. These hard, ongoing economic conditions are probably why merchants began another period of investing in London property market, as opposed to speculative trade deals. And it is clear in 1401 that discontent was growing. But like water from a leaking tap, this anger seeped into the city, seeking a way to vent itself. It is perhaps not surprising that if you remove the political way for people to vent their anger, theology would end up being employed. If people could not express dissent towards their political leaders, perhaps they could towards their religious leaders. At a meeting in Westminster before Parliament and the assembled clergy that year, it was reported that, quote, "the Lollards, assembling in London from every part of the kingdom, intended to utterly to destroy the clergy," unquote. Well, this claim was somewhat of an exaggeration. It does describe a growing concern and debate within England. While I have not given this aspect of the story of London as much space or as time as I think is required, the issue of church reform was ongoing, and London became a bit of a hotbed for it. There were interesting theological issues and debates taking place within church circles. But while the traditional story goes that John Wycliffe, the Oxford theologian, had started a movement called the Lollards, in truth, the reality on this issue was much more complex. As I've said in previous episodes, Wycliffe was ultimately just an Oxford academic whose arguments were presented within the ivory towers of church academia. He never sought nor desired to set up some kind of grassroots movement. And added to this, as we have seen from the likes of John Bull during the Peasants' Revolt, there were priests operating who held extremely radical beliefs that predated Wycliffe and to whom Wycliffe's detractors linked to try to discredit him. But, be that as it may, there was a desire for church reform going on out in the country, and this has been pushed back by the existing church authorities. And both sides were seeking secular support for the crown, and places of social discontent who found their political avenues being closed off now ended up supporting one of these causes. Henry IV was in a slightly awkward position. His father, John of Gaunt, as Duke of Lancaster, had been a patron and supporter of Wycliffe, and some hoped as king he would maintain that support. At that gathering in 1401 in Westminster, these issues came to a head, and they combined with the new king's need for ecclesiastical support, and the church leaders deciding to test the king's resolve to do his duty, and the laity's resolve to obey their edicts, by using two tactics. The first was to formally present a petition which detailed how the mainstream clergy wished to see the state counter heterodox theological opinions. That was adopted. But for the clergy at that gathering in 1401, they also had a more visceral demonstration up their sleeve. You see, there was this chaplain attached to the church of St. Bennet Shearhog in St. Pancras Lane, London, who was called William Sawtrey. William, also called William Chatteries or William Sawtrey, depending on the source, had originally been a priest up in King's Lynn. Up there, they'd been charged with heresy for holding Lolland opinions by the Bishop of Norwich, and he was condemned for it, but then had recanted those views and was pardoned in 1400. He had subsequently relocated to this church in St. Pancras Lane, where he relapsed and was now imprisoned by ecclesiastical authorities. Sawtrey was tried again, this time in public in Westminster. In February 1401, he was brought out for questioning five times during that month. But while he had tried to sound accommodating when things started, in time he became increasingly belligerent and argumentative. By the 26th of February, he was declared incorrigible and passed over to the lay powers of the land to be punished as a heretic. The king passed the test. He drafted an order that very day to the mayor and sheriffs of London, empowering them to burn Sawtrey. This was finally done on Wednesday, the 2nd of March. Now defiant and raging, Sawtrey hurled abuse at the Archbishop of Canterbury and prophesying the ruin of the kingdom, quote, "I, sent by God, declare to thee that thou and all thy clergy and the king also shall die anon an evil death, and the tongue of a strange people shall hold sway in the land, and this evil standeth waiting even in the gates," unquote. Sawtrey was dragged out of the city to the other place of execution, Smithfield, and there he was bound by a chain, stood upright to a post. The post was then set in a barrel, with kindling set around it, and this was set on fire. Screaming out defiance, Sawtrey burned to death, quote, "and was thus reduced to ashes." London gained, over these next few years, its reputation as a focal point for the Lollards. And while it'd be wrong to say that the support of Lollardy had economic drivers, there is a link between increased underlying tensions within the city and the support given to those who suggested church reform. Remember, the people at the time were deeply religious and given to seeing signs and potents in everything. And even a cynical and tough population like London was not immune to religious passions. As Adam Vosk tells us, around now there was an excited new miracle to witness as, quote, "four little bells hanging on the four corners of the shrine of St. Edward in Westminster, ringing off their own accord and with more than human power, miraculously sounded four times in one day, to the great awe and wonder of the brethren," unquote. Wow, was this a miracle? Or just a draft? Who knows? Still, even in a city famed for its draconian law and order, there were some changes taking place. The Tun Prison, located on Cornhill, which had for the last 120 years been used to incarcerate night walkers and lewd women, and whose building I mentioned all the way back in Chapter 73, was torn down in 1402. In its place was erected a new water conduit supplying fresh water from the Tyburn Springs. The crimes it had been used for were not ignored. Next to the water conduit, a smaller jail with stocks and a pillory were placed to continue to deal with night walkers, but also for dishonest bakers and millers to be punished for short measures. Over these few years, we would also see the combined guild of those Londoners involved in writing letters, bookbinding and bookselling was created, in time known as the Company of Stationers. And in 1404, the Merchant Tailors Company this year acquired a site in Threadneedle Street, next to the Church of St. Martin Outwich, to begin to build some almshouses. They eventually consisted of seven dwellings there. But to this day, the Merchant Tailors of London connection to almshouses and homes for the elderly is well known and maintained. You'll find some lovely ones out in Lewisham, I believe. Crucially for London, however, the city was witnessing a very turbulent few years. It was hoped that the new regime would herald in a new broom to improve everything across the nation. It did not. Henry IV, as we said, soon gained a reputation for ineptitude in his finances, and his state was soon hit by much wider instability. And it began to manifest itself by sightings of the late King Richard. Like Elvis Presley, he was spotted all over the place. People said they saw the late king in Berwick on the borders of Scotland. Others said he was spotted in the valleys of Wales. And some even said he was spotted in Westminster. And by 1402, these rumours were spreading. The rumours were born out of a growing disillusionment of Henry's rule during those first few years of his reign, and he seems to be beset on all sides almost automatically. In Wales, we see a sudden uprising as a new generation of leaders began armed insurrection against the English. In Scotland, there was a new outbreak of fighting on the border. Piracy exploded in the English Channel, reaching epidemic levels very quickly, and fighting restarted over in France. Added to this, we now had government insolvency and the sudden overwhelming prevalence of social disorder. With the economy stuttering, London looked at the new king and the utter chaos going on around him and wondered, where the hell was this going to end up? London found itself again making generous financial provision to the regime as crown income suddenly plummeted. The impact of the increase in piracy reduced customs revenues by totally disrupting trade, but necessitated much increased expenditure on the defence of the sea. The fees required by the Percy dynasty for protecting the Scottish marches during the first 3 years of the reign came to a grand total of £40,000, but Scottish devastation and the need to provide manpower for border defence meant that some of the northern counties had to be exempted from paying taxes. Domestic unrest across the rest of the country meant there could not be any reduction in the size of the royal retinue within the state. Signs of strain soon appeared. We see letters sent to the Royal Council bitterly complaining of the inability of the King's lieutenants and officials to carry out the tasks demanded of them owing to a lack of funds. Between May and July of 1402, more than £16,000 were borrowed by the Exchequer, much of it paid by Londoners to whom royal plate and crown jewels were actually handed over as security. Yet soon after, the new king instructed his treasurer to summon 300 of the nation's lords, knights and esquires to attend a great council, and he was regretfully told that the crown did not have enough money to pay the messengers to bear these summons. One account of the time says, quote, "Around this time, grumbling broke out amongst the people against the king, merely because he received provisions but paid nothing for them," unquote. Parliament joined in, claiming that there was, quote, "great clamour throughout the realm," unquote, at the royal household's failure to pay its debts. I was asked by a listener on the Buy Me a Coffee webpage recently if King's loans were ever repaid, and the answer is, as we see with Richard II and Henry IV, no. Not always. The Crown did not always repay the loans given to it. Sometimes they paid off their debts with other rewards. A man might gain a knighthood for a large giving of cash to the crown, or, like Dick Whittington, might be made mayor, or for the sum of money gain the right to do something like hold a monopoly. Patronage from the crown meant they always had ways of paying off their lenders, but not in cash. And the bottom line truth is that the crown of England was, throughout this period, a bad debt. But as London had learned brutally only a decade before, to not loan the crown money could result in the king curtailing, eroding and removing rights and privileges which you had gained in the past. With all this in mind, as we enter the year 1404, we see a genuine fear across England, and London especially, that the explosion of mob violence that had rocked England and the city in 1381 could be repeated. Indeed, in 1404, we read that in London, quote, "At the congregation of the mayor, aldermen and common council in the Guildhall for the election of sheriffs for the ensuing year, such an exceeding number of apprentices and serving men belonging to citizens of said city, as well as of other men, strangers to the freedom of the city, was without any summons assembled together in the same Guildhall. And so loud and so clamorous was their shouting that the mayor and the aldermen were unable to understand the reason for their noise, to the manifest troubling and disturbance of the said mayor. It was ordained and established that in future, as well as at the election of the mayor, as of the sheriffs and all other officers of said city, no person, of whatever estate or condition he may be, shall presume to enter the Guildhall for the purpose of taking part in any election therein, unless he shall be especially summoned and chosen to make such an election by the sergeants of the mayor for the time being, on the understanding also that no one shall be summoned to any election hereafter, unless he be one of the more substantial men of said city, or one of the common council," unquote. But it wasn't just inner London that was seeing this tension. Around London and to the north, all the way to the Midlands, bands of highwaymen were terrorising travellers and even threatening royal officials. Gangs were breaking into abbeys and not only robbing them but killing their monks and the servants. The epidemic of plague and widespread harvest failure in the autumn of 1400 was followed by 1402's catastrophic fall in wool production owing to flooding and disease. And by 1404, well, a storm fell upon the North Sea that November, and we know it smashed into the Netherlands with a ferocity not seen in decades. The first Elizabeth's flood utterly devastated the lands on that side of the channel, and so crucial were they to the English wool trade. And while we have no record of its impact here in England, it would be foolish to pretend it did not also cause havoc across the south and east coasts of England. On to the rumours that Richard was alive. Now came more dangerous prophecies and portents, which illustrate the pervasive sense of foreboding that now fell upon England. The devil himself was said to have appeared in Danbury and Essex, and anybody who knows Danbury wouldn't be surprised by that. And the grand storms in the sky, like the comet blazing which heralded in the change in regime in the first place, all seemed to indicate that the times were all out of joint. No surprise then, I suppose, that because of trouble and violence in Southwark in 1405, we see bailiffs being ordered to ban any assemblies of people down there. Only the lords of England, such as the royal knights and squires, were permitted to carry weapons in Southwark. Outside in England, the various factions around this beleaguered king began to jar and clash. The hopes and dreams of a new regime's rise were gone, and London was stuck now supporting a king who seemed to be assailed on all sides, beleaguered and under attack and unable to catch a single breath. For good or for bad, the city of London was aligned to this listing ship of a regime, and the weather ahead was stormy indeed. And at that, I'm going to end it there. Thanks for listening. Hope you enjoyed it. I'll be back again next week for another episode of The Story of London. If you wish to support us, then the easiest way to do that would be to give us a 5-star like, or even write us a review on Apple. These things really do impress the algorithms that control how much, well, attention a podcast gets. So that's the freest and easiest way you can help us, because we get more listeners. If you want to support us a little bit more, you can make a one-off gift or a regular contribution to the Buy Me a Coffee site, which allows us to continue going on and cover things like hosting fees and whatever, but it's not compulsory. Anyway, enough of me talking. I don't like these bits at the end. I always feel very awkward. I'll be back again next week. I hope you have had a lovely week and that the weather where you are is lovely and pleasant. All right, I'll see you then. Bye.